Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Adrian from the South College of Grove. Welcome. Wow. You guys take care of us up here. You provide water and digital clocks. I don't know what we do about that at South College. We're like, just get up there. I'm sorry. I'm a little... First of all, I'm so thankful for this microphone. I normally hate them, but I'm really sick, so I'm glad I won't sound like a frog. If I fade out, I brought people with me. They'll come up here. So, but my name's Adrian. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is South College Speakers. It's right in the heart of University of Delaware. If you guys are ever in Delaware for any absurd reason, please come down. If you don't stop, you might miss it. Like, it's a very small place, but big pocket of enthusiasm down there. So if you guys come or any time down there, we love new people. We love everyone. Give me a minute. Way down. I had to pee so bad. I would have been here a couple minutes earlier, but we took the long way, and it's four alcoholics in one car thinking they know best. So I think you know. I think you know how that turns out. And I'm so thrilled to be at Quakertown. And as you'll see later when I get into my story, Quakertown is such a huge, it's where I had one of my little spiritual awakenings, is the best way I can put it. And I'm so grateful that this meeting was here, because if it wasn't, I'm not sure I would have went on the path that I did. But I'll get to that. And I love speaker meetings in general, because number one, when I was a newcomer, I didn't have to talk when I came to speaker meetings, so that was great. And secondly, it's the first place that I ever heard a message of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not that there wasn't a message of hope present in these other meetings, but if there was, I didn't hear it. The first meeting, I thought when I went to my first speaker meeting, it was actually in Wilmington, Delaware, Fairfax Speakers, and there was this girl up there, and I just tore her to pieces within 30 seconds of how she's not like me and so forth. And there was a lot of guys there, too, so that's one of the reasons why I went, unfortunately. But I heard this girl up there, and I was like, you know what? They should let me talk. They should. You know, I could tell everyone about Adrian, how she's born on September 5th, and she's this and she's that. And believe it or not, the first time I was asked to speak, I had note cards ready about how, you know, how I was and how I liked animals and my hobbies and all these things. And I'm like, that's really going to help someone, Adrian. But I thought it was the Adrian show. And thank God that it's not. Thank God that it's not. And my primary purpose is obviously to help someone that's still suffering. Whew. Like I said, I'm really excited about this bottle of water because I forgot mine. One of the things that I always emphasize with girls that I help is that this disease was present with me a long time before I ever used alcohol or drugs to try to medicate it. And people love to argue with me about that, but it's just my own little personal truth, and it's something that I find a lot of other women like me relate to. And before I get into anything further, I love alcohol, and I love Jägermeister and everything that comes along with it, but I love cocaine and OxyContin, too, and if that offends you, I apologize. Just getting it out there, though. One of the things, I had this complex when I came in that I was not an alcoholic. I was just a drug addict that liked to drink while I was doing drugs. And thankfully, people, you know, told me, please put your delusional mind to the side for just a couple minutes and just open up your mind and see what happens. So when I'm drinking, just for the purposes of this conversation, because I have so much respect for AA because it gave me a life. I had a life before that, but it was kind of more like an existence. But like I said, this disease was here a long time before I ever knew about it. It was just this innate disconnection from everybody and everything, and I'm sure at speaker meetings you've heard that a million times, said a million different ways. But it was just this feeling of being foreign around everyone I was, especially my own family. I have a father who looks like he just spit me out, like we look identical, and he's one of us too. He doesn't quite know it yet, but he is, and he said, I know what that's about. It's a bunch of murderers and rapists and blah, blah, blah. That's his perception, but it's funny, like I've told him that I've said that at meetings. He's like, well, it's the truth. Like, he doesn't really see it yet, so, but there was a lot of alcoholism in my family. I do believe this is genetic. And I don't tell you that because I used to love, that was my favorite thing to do, to say I was a drug addict because my daddy was one, and it's contagious, and, you know, you're on this way because of this happened, this, this, and this. And, you know, I was such a victim when I came in. But I'm just telling you that because that's just how it was. My family, I'm the oldest of three, and I grew up, I actually live in Maryland, but I'm right on the line for Delaware and Maryland, so. But either way, there was a lot of chaos going on in the house, and I had this prime example of what alcoholism, addiction, whatever, does to a family. And I swore that I would never be like that. And God has a really funny sense of humor. But just to give you a couple like quick examples of what I was like as a kid, I mean, 4 years old, I had to be lied to about going to preschool. Like, my mother had to lie to me to get me in the car. And then she'd drop me off and leave, and I would freak out. Like, and I remember I was the only person doing this, and I felt even more alienated. And I was just so terrified of absolutely everything. Like, other children, other people in general just scared the shit out of me for some reason. I just remember she would say, go play with other kids. And I'm like, what did I do wrong? Why are you punishing me? I don't understand. And just never feeling okay with me or with anybody else. And just this feeling of alienation. And I could never identify it. Like, I could never go up to you and say, I'm suffering from a hopeless state of mind. Help me. Like, it just never crossed my mind. I thought everyone kind of felt like that. But at the same time, I thought it was different. Very, I don't know, kind of an oxymoron. But, and I thought, you know, in preschool, I had this name that no one else had. Like, I wanted a name like Jessica or Brittany or Ashley, something common, at least that I thought it was common at the time. And no one had it. And I was so mad at my parents over this. At 5 years old, this is the kind of thing I was obsessing about. And then I found someone that did have my name, and it was a boy. I freaked out. I had, like, an 8-year-old midlife crisis over me having a boy's name. And I was just a mess. Like, all the time, everything was a crisis, a life-or-death situation, everything. And, God, whew, terrified of men. I was excused from my gym class because a man was a teacher, because I'd have panic attacks. And I wasn't even abused at this point yet. So it was just this natural self-centered fear. I don't know where it came from. And I just had this natural self-loathing. That's the only thing I could tell you. I was never okay with who I was. I didn't even know who I was yet, but I just wasn't okay with it, whatever it was. And it just came to me the other day. It's funny how things come back to you. God reveals more, you know, the longer I'm around. But I remember when I was like 9 or 10, I had this obsession with makeup. I mean, obsession with it. My mom was like, you're 9 years old. I don't think so. And I was like, yeah, okay. I had to have it. If you look at my complexion, you can't wear bright blue green eyeliner with my eyes or bright red lipstick. I look like a clown. And I was like 9 or 10 years old, but I had to have it. Had to have it because I thought like I was so despicable to other people. But if I had it, I felt okay. And I felt like, oh, well, maybe someone will like me, so I'll feel better about myself. I had suicidal thoughts from like age 9. I mean, I can't even. And I had to come to AA to find out that wasn't normal behavior. It says in our big book, our alcoholic life's the only normal one we know. And but here's the thing, is that remember I told you that I have a lot of alcoholism in my family, and I had this very huge, huge resentment against my mother for staying with my dad and all the pain and suffering that came along with it. So I made this little promise to myself. I think I was about 11 or 12. And my exact words were, I will never be like that son of a bitch. I will never hurt my family. I will never do this. I will never do that. And in the next 10 years, I did all those things, probably times 10. But at that particular time, I went the other way with it. And I liked feeling superior to people, as if you'd like to call it. I didn't think I had an ego problem when I came into AA either. But I remember saying, when I speak, they're going to have to sell tickets because I'm going to save everyone and sponsor the whole East Coast. And didn't think I had an ego problem, though. But either way, I went into sports, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it because I had a lot of athletic ability, but I just had a head full of craziness. And just the only reason I ever did it was so someone could say, wow, look at her. Wow, look at her. And I didn't have any love for the sport of softball. I mean, I love it now, but back then the reasons for playing it and being competitive are not the same. But so I did really well, and I thought, wow, my life would be just perfect if I got a scholarship. It would be. Like, I had my life intricately planned out, intricately, like who I was going to marry, how many kids I was going to have, what kind of car, what house, where at, what college, what friends, everything. And when it didn't turn out that way, it was like, I didn't realize I was playing God, but Either way, so I do that. I mean, I get so strung out on being in the best shape possible. I exercise twice a day, every day, like had to be the best at everything because you have to be perfect. You know, I had to come to AA to find out there is no such thing as human perfection, but I thought there was. And I got this high off of being smarter than people, so I thought. I came into AA, told everyone I was valedictorian. It's just not true. I was 7. And I had to tell people that. Like, I had to come clean about it. But it's just, like, within 5 minutes of knowing me, you would have to know, hey, I'm a valedictorian. No, you're really not. But I just needed you to know I was important because I didn't feel important. So if you thought I was important, maybe I'd feel important. Like, it's very exhausting, needless to say, trying to run your life. So I did get this scholarship. Sorry, this is icy. I was 17. When I was 15, I had my first spiritual experience, and his name was Anthony, and he was beautiful. And I was so absolutely obsessed with Anthony Battaglia. And I tell him that he's in my story. He doesn't give a shit. We kind of laugh about it now, but he was the epitome of beautiful in my mind. He was everything to me. And we'd only been on one date. So if you can imagine, I had our marriage planned out. He's like, whoa, he's not one of us. But he was just a really nice guy. He's captain of the football team, blah, blah, blah. And I took his virginity and I was like, yes, I'm going to tell everyone that I did that because then they're going to think I'm so important. I was a very sick person. But either way, like, the way that I needed him was so abnormal. Like, the relationship was unhealthy from the get-go. And he kept trying to get away, and I was like, he's just playing hard to get, that's all. And I'll just do that. Men are like drugs to me. That's the only way I can put it to you, is that in sobriety, I had to learn some things about my sex conduct that weren't so nice. But I'm so grateful for it. I thought it was normal to take people hostage. Like, I remember this one guy, I really don't like calling him my fiancé, but that's what I was blabbing when I first came into AA about him. And he was really more like a drug dealer and a bartender. But I said, he ran from me one night. When I was in my addiction, I was probably about 20 pounds smaller than what I am now. This man was like 250, big guy. He ran from me. Ran from me out of our house. I was thrown. I mean, I was crazy. And I told him, I said, if you leave, I will punch myself in the face and call the cops and tell them you did it. And I was dead serious when I said that. Like, I was not below that. And that's the type of hostage taker I am. I'm a literal form of that. But either way, like, back to Anthony, I just thought if I had him, my world would be right. Everyone would look at me and say, wow, look who, she must be important. She must be worth something. He didn't see it that way. But what I always say, and it's just a stupid little joke, is that I was willing to change my sexual identity for this man. If he would have told me he was gay, I would have tried to grow a penis because I was so obsessed. Like, obsessed to a point I didn't know what love was. I didn't know what companionship was. I just knew what obsession was. And he wasn't feeling it. So he went away to college, and I get this scholarship. And I'm 17, and I'm at this graduation party that my parents threw for me. I have this large, obnoxious Italian family that just wants to love you. They fight a lot, but they have beautiful hearts. I'm around all these people, and I'm around a couple acquaintances. I didn't really have any close friends because I didn't really like women. Just looked at them as competition, and they're just jealous anyway, type mentality. I just got a scholarship to play softball at the beach, 4 years paid for. I had a nice car. I was just given a couple $1,000s by my family because there's so many of us that you give $20. It adds up. And Anthony was back in the picture. I don't know what made him see the light, but he actually wanted something to do with me. And I have all this love around me, and I can't feel it. Couldn't feel a thing. And I wasn't able to identify it back then. I wasn't saying, oh, my God, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. Somebody help me. It wasn't like that. It was just this feeling of emptiness, this feeling of, like, isn't there more? What's missing? What is missing from my life? And, that's not a nice feeling when you have everything that society tells you you shouldn't have to be happy, and you're just absolutely miserable on the inside. Before this, back up to when I was 13, I did have my first drink at 13. Problem was with it is that it just wasn't quite as accessible. And it was peach schnapps. It wasn't anything spectacular. It was on New Year's Day, I believe. I was watching a Three Stooges marathon. And I was by myself. And my dad, I think, was hungover or passed out, something like that. My mom worked two jobs. So I had my two little brothers. And one of them's much younger than me, and the other one's right about my age, who I despised. And the little one was like my little protege, and he thought that I walked on water, so he was cool. But other than that, I was by myself. I took this drink of peach schnapps. And I didn't remember this until I was like 6 months sober. I was convinced I wasn't an alcoholic anyway. But either way, that allergy kicked in right away that big book talks about. It's like I took a sip. It was like I had a thing of orange juice because I saw my mom do that, make fuzzy navels. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I should just put some orange juice in there. And there was plenty of orange juice left afterwards. We'll just put it that way. I kept going back, but I'm like, okay, well, I need to make sure there's something in the bottle left so that I don't get in trouble. So I put an empty bottle back in the fridge. And surprisingly, no one ever caught on to it. But at that point, like, I couldn't access it as much as I wanted to. So 17 comes along, and I tell everyone when I go off to the school, first of all, I made it maybe about a month, 5 weeks, something like that. And I said they don't appreciate my talent there. And I made up the story about how I got raped, and I believed it. I told everyone that, and it's so sick that I used that because I wasn't capable of being honest with myself to tell myself the truth, and that was that I could not go to class because I was so terrified of people. And I just didn't know what was wrong with me. I just figured out it's just a stage. It just wasn't the right fit, blah, 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 blah. And I just couldn't be honest with myself because I didn't know what was wrong with me. So I get another scholarship to the University of South Carolina. But this time I was too afraid to even go. I was like, no, it's not for me. I'm not a Southern type of girl. But then I hate myself for not going, and I have all this self-pity, and it's just a mess. So I ended up staying home, and whoo, this is where it gets fun. I was drinking with friend Heather, and up until this point, I thought drinking and driving was just something everybody did, and it's not a big deal, and everyone sneaks underage drinks. It's just something that you do. And I didn't realize that not everyone gets so shit-faced every single time they drink. I thought, you know, it was just what you did. But the whole time, my mom's kind of worried, but she doesn't want to say anything because she's like, you know what, she didn't have good luck at college. Maybe it's just a phase. That's what it is. It's just a phase. So I was like, yeah, it's just a phase. It'll be fine. Trust me. I'll get my shit together, I promise. But here's what happens. I decide that I want to be a nurse because my original plight was to be a doctor. Not because I want to help people. I hate people. I don't. I want the salary, and I want the doctor in front of my name. I want you to call me doctor. That's what I wanted. Really, really bad. I wanted that prestige so badly. And that was such a driving force in my addiction. What was I getting at that? Oh, nursing school. So I bust my ass to get accepted into nursing school. And like I said, I'm telling everyone I'm a genius, so why wouldn't I get accepted into nursing school? Jesus. Either way, I'm with this boyfriend. And if you can't see these alcoholic tendencies, they are so blatantly obvious, it's ridiculous. But I pick this guy who likes to degrade me and cheat on me on a regular basis. And I think I'm going to save him and change him, and everything will just be perfect. But the way that I interacted with men was so sick. I mean, with anybody, it was just so sick. But either way, I'm in the middle of school. I just got accepted into this program. It was really hard to get into. And I start drinking again. But this time, I add a couple other substances into it. And the best way that I can describe this to you, it's like I felt alive for the first time. Like I've been just dead the whole time, like the zombie walking around aimlessly trying to figure out what's wrong with her life. But all of a sudden, that mind that races constantly, that tension that was always there just disappeared. And I felt the most amazing freedom that I've, up until that point, that I'd ever felt. And I didn't say this out loud, but I do remember thinking, I have to do this as much as possible. And I was fine with it. And that next year was probably one of the best years of my life. I got to be completely honest with you. I didn't pay a lot of consequences. I was working. I wasn't running out of money. And that's all I really, that was my primary purpose, was to get as obliterated as possible. You don't even have to tell me what it is. I'll take it as long as it does the job. I just felt this freedom. Like, all those ambitions that I had were not there anymore. The only ambition I had was to get as drunk as possible, to get as high as possible. And I did anything and everything to do it. If you got in my way between me and my liquor, it was bad. That little brother I was telling you about, I played a pretty big part in raising him. Like I said, my mom worked two jobs, and if I become one quarter the mother that I have, I will be really happy about it, because she's just naturally principled. Like, she went over, like, my neighbor was going through a hard time. I still don't understand this, but she just went over and weeded her whole garden. And she has rheumatoid arthritis, but she did this. And she's like, don't tell anyone about it. I was like, I would want to, like, knock on her door and then go do it so she could see I was doing it, so that, you know, like, I don't understand that. She just naturally does that. She knows what the right thing to do is, and she does it. And that's never been me. I know what the right thing to do is, but that's not the best thing for me, so I'm not going to do that. Very self-centered. But either way, what was I talking about? And then it got worse. It's basically, like, the nutshell of the story. Oh yes, those fun times. Ended up getting a house with that bartender, drug dealer guy. That was a lot of fun. Playing house, I'm not good at that either. The way that I was drinking and drugging, like I said, I always knew it was abnormal. But the problem was that I thought no one else knew. Like, I was the last person to know I was an alcoholic. Everyone else knew it but me. And to speed up just a little bit, my grandfather and my grandmother were huge parts of my life. And there was significant amounts of times I tried to get sober before that I did. I did the methadone clinic route. I did the Suboxone clinic route. I did the anabuse route. I did the just don't drink and do drugs, just do drugs, don't drink, just drink on the weekends, just drink at work. More about alcoholism, that whole thing. I was like, damn it, I am. Like, because I wanted every possible excuse to not be an alcoholic, because it was, like, the worst thing you could call me. Like, I would get, it felt like someone was just stabbing me when you called me an alcoholic. Like, it was just the stigma attached to that word. When I came to my first meeting, I think it was, like, 4 years ago, and I told people my name was Andrea, because I was so terrified someone would recognize me and be like, oh, my God, you're an alcoholic. But either way, my grandfather had died. Went back out on my 22nd birthday, something like that. Either way, last time it's on. Last time I heard his voice was a voicemail, and I'm sure you all know about those voicemails, just begging to know that I was alive. Because when I go out, you don't see me for a while. I hide. The things that I do aren't. The hell I put my family through, that's a living amends that I try to live up to every day, because the peace of mind that I rob people from. But he was just begging and crying for me to just call. He said, I won't lecture you. I just want to know that you're alive. That's it. And I didn't have the courage to do it. And he died about a month and a half later. He was a pretty healthy guy, but it was just a knee surgery that went wrong. And I told my mother I would come to the funeral if she paid me. That was the type of person I was. That's what you're dealing with right here. And I was so obliterated at that funeral, I don't remember much of it. But I remember it was an embarrassment, because my parents were in so much pain. I couldn't see anybody but myself. I used that excuse that my grandfather died to get breaks at the bar and get breaks. Very sick person. But needless to say, you would think, oh, that's a bad experience, Adrian. You should stop it. Cut it out. My mind doesn't work that way. It says in the big book, like, we can't bring to memory with sufficient force the suffering and humiliation. I'm the type of girl that goes into detox and I'm drunk when I'm out. Like, there's no logic to this. And my grandmother would always say, Adrian, honey, just stop. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. And you would think so. You would think, like, drinking and drugging causing you all these problems. Just stop it. You'll be okay. That's just not my experience. I wish it was, because if that was the case, I might have been sober a long, long time ago. But either way, at this funeral I went to, my family is just at a point where, like, they're looking at me and they're like, there's no hope for this girl. We don't know what to do. They're neurotic. You know, we sicken the people around us. I'm definitely sure of that. But either way, I'm here, and I'm pretending to be crying in the back room of my mom's house and looking through pictures, but what I'm really doing is going through his wallet. And I never saw a problem with it. And when I got called on it, I was like, he didn't need it. I did. Like, I did not see anything wrong with this scenario. A couple weeks later, I was in detox, you know, again, just a mess. And I didn't really want to get sober. I still had a lot of ideas about how I can control this, because that's all I want to do is shoot opiates and drink and live a successful life. That's the delusion that I lived under, is if I can just tweak it just right and get the right job and the right this and run my own life, everything will be fine. Wasn't until a couple months later, June 15th, oh, that's my sobriety date, I'm sorry, June 15th, 2010. I probably should have mentioned that. I do have a sponsor. She's in the back laughing, but I forgot that. I wouldn't be up here if I didn't have a sponsor. That's imperative for a person like me. What was I getting at? Off track again, and then it got worse. I would never go off track. No. Ooh, that's it. When I come out this time, my grandmother, who has Alzheimer's, went to live with my mom. And I'm the type of girl who I had this really awesome job. I made way too much money for a person like me. I worked at a yacht club. And I said, those people are like me. They just don't run out of money. That's what the problem is. But either way, like, I'm such a victim. If I could just have a liquor store to myself, everything would be fine. It's kind of how I looked at it. But either way, I get to this, I'm living at home like maybe a day a week. Like, I go to work and I'll be like, see you tonight. And then I'm gone for the next 6 days and no one knows where I am. And but in this meantime, I found that my grandmother was on some really high narcotics, and she wasn't aware that she was on these narcotics because she had Alzheimer's. And my mom made the mistake of doing the code to the safe, because you got to lock your shit up when you're around me. My brother lost his keys, and they thought I stole them. And my mom goes, Tony, what do you expect? Like, she's right there. Lock your shit up. Like, I was that kind of girl. And either way, I steal all this medication. And I replaced it with some other medication because I think I'm smart. And I almost killed her. I watched her go through withdrawal and I didn't care. And I say that now because that doesn't haunt me anymore. Because this program and these steps have given me the opportunity to grow and to make amends and to be free of it and to actually help other people with that. That's what God does, is he takes all those nasty, awful things that I've done and he turns it into opportunity to be of service. And how beautiful is that? But either way, this happens, and my mom is just, she's just done. And she's the most loving person I know, but she's like, Adrian, you have to go. You are a hazard to everyone here. And I was like, okay, whatever. You know, what I always say, because everyone always says, slow down, slow down. I'm like, yeah, go ahead. And I'd always, like, tell people what they want to hear, but I would always do what I wanted to do. And ends up, like, I just see this checkbook, and I just have this bad habit of writing out checks to myself from other people's checkbooks. A lot of financial amends came to that. But either way, I write it out to $500. It didn't last me a day. And I'm sick and in this hotel that everyone gets. Seems like someone dies every other day, but, you know, I thought I was in paradise. And she comes, and they just have this look on their face, like, what happened? What happened to you? The hopelessness in their eyes, because they're seeing their firstborn slowly kill themselves. And I never thought about that. That never occurred to me. I'm like, I'm not hurting anybody but me. Get over it. You know, this is my life. And the reason they came was because my brother came home the night before, hid his keys, but he was drunk and forgot about it. They thought I stole his keys. And I'm like, how dare you? I would never. Like, and he came back and apologized to me when he found them. They hadn't found out that I just ripped them off for $500. But when they did, they said, look, you can go to rehab or we're calling the cops. Take your pick. And I was like, can I think about it a little bit? Because I didn't want to go to rehab. I didn't want to get help because as far as I was concerned, AA didn't work. I tried the other fellowship online. I don't recommend that. You can do online meetings. And I remember on New Year's, I had my glass of wine. And I was typing all this stuff about recovery. Thought I was nice and recovered. That was fun. So my experience with rehab, wow, we're moving time, was that I went to Bowling Green. I don't know if anyone, it's kind of near here, I guess, kind of. I didn't want to go. I literally was trying to jump out of the car on the way there. My mom was like, is there something that's possessed my daughter? It's not her. And I was like, yeah, alcoholism. But at the time, like, I was just suicidal. I was yelling at the top of my lungs in this waiting room, acting like a crazy person because I thought I might get a sedative if I acted crazy enough. And they didn't give me one. But I stayed there for 17 days. But in the meantime, my insurance company, who I was, this is the only time I prayed, I was like, God, please don't let them take my insurance because I don't want to go. he had other plans. But either way, my mom was outside arguing for 3 hours. And if you've ever been physically dependent on a substance, you know how long that is. It's like eternity. And I'm just calling her these awful names and telling her if she leaves me, she's never going to see me again. And I'm going to get raped and die and blah, blah, blah. And just all these awful things. And she's crying. And I've seen my mother cry, God, seems like millions of times. But she fell off the step out there. And for whatever reason, I look at it now as divine intervention. Some people like to dispute that, but for me, I know that it was. Because she fell, and she sprained her wrist, and she's a medical transcriptionist, so you need your hands. And my grandfather just died 7 months prior. My father is an active alcoholic and drug addict. She's got me, and she's got my grandmother, who doesn't know what she ate for breakfast, and, like, having to take care of her. Her life is just in shambles. And she is just sobbing with her arm like that, and for 5 minutes, I didn't shake. I did not shake. I did not think about me. I thought about her. And it was kind of like God opening the curtains for me and saying, look what you've become. Look at the monster. Look how you're tearing through people's lives. Like, what are you doing? And I cried, and, 5 minutes later, I was back to normal, like, trying to kill somebody. But the point was, is that I actually made this decision that, yeah, this is hurting me, and this is hurting everyone. It's killing me. And I had had glimpses of that prior to it, but my alcoholic delusional mind tells me it'll be different, that you can control it. It'll be fine. But anyway, my father to this day is still convinced that I pushed her, but she's tried to set him straight because I was not below that. I mean, if you tried to get between me, I remember pushing my little brother, who I love like a son. I literally threw him out of my way to try to get out the door because this craving is beyond mental control. Dr. Silkworth puts it perfectly. I don't hold with people that think this is something like that. I don't know how to quote the big book. I know it, and I can try to help someone with it, but I can't quote it all the time. I was like, okay, and in rehab, I'm like 12 days sober, and this is my MO, guys. Like, I get my complexion back. I don't look green. I gain a little bit of weight. Not really sleeping, but I'm starting to, like, try to look good on the outside, and that's what I've been doing for a while. And might even get a job, depending on how many weeks it is. But in rehab, I'm 12 days sober, and this thought hits me that if I leave, I'll be drunk. And I'm like Dr. Young and Roland Hazard. I'm like, I'm either going to have to be locked up or go permanently insane. Those are your choices. And I knew it. Like, in the bottom of my heart, I knew it. And I have this war going on in my mind 24/7. I really don't want to do this anymore. I know it's killing me. One more won't hurt. Come on. Come on. You know you can do this. And it's just constant, like, all the time. And I didn't think anyone understood. And I knew that I was going to die. I was certain of it. And I went to this counselor who seemed like she had her shit together, and I was like, tell me what to do. And she said, go pray. And I'm like, that is the lamest idea I've ever heard, but I don't really have any other ideas. So that's what I went and did. I went down by the Ducks at Bowling Green, and I said, God, if you're there, I'm really lost, and I'm really scared, and I don't want to die. If you could please help me. Because I think what kind of kicked this in was that the Philly cops came in. I don't know if anyone's been to a rehab or a Scare You Straight program. It just doesn't work with me because they show you pictures of Jack Daniels and, like, then a dead body from DUIs, and then they show you OxyContin, and then they show you an overdose, and I'm salivating. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I couldn't be within a mile radius of anything like that. Like, my obsession was merciless. Like, you couldn't say the word around me. I'd start, like, because I didn't want to do it anymore. But I'd been using drugs and drinking against my will for such a long time. And that's not fun. Like, because I kept wanting it to be like it was in the beginning. It just wasn't there. But I come out of this rehab and they told me to go to AA. And I never listened to anybody, but I knew that I didn't have any other choices. I was out of schemes. I was out of ideas. So I went, and I saw this beautiful man. He was sharing the meeting. And they told me to look for someone you want what they have. And I was like, well, I want everything he has. And he was like, women stick with the women. And I was like, huh, we'll see about that. And but either way, the next day I met my sponsor. And she was exactly what I needed at that time. I'm certain God put her in my life to help save my life. I'm eternally grateful for that. But she listened. Because, you know, I thought it was so unique. And you come into AA and this disease makes you feel like you're the only one that has it for some reason. I mean, it's the only one I know of that tries to convince you you don't have it, too. That's fun. But she's just listening, and she's taking so much time out of her day. The first AA meeting I went to was on 4th of July. Or, I'm sorry, the 4th one. And I didn't know you guys were open on holidays, so I thought, like, I would go early. That way, like, if you guys were closed for fireworks and... she actually had her daughter, who's in the program, who came along tonight, come get me. And I went to this meeting before the one that I went to later. And it was a bunch of guys, older men, bitching about how they can't drink anymore. And it's 4th of July, and they just want a cold beer and this and this and this. And I was like, oh, my God. I was like, if this is what AA is, I'm in trouble. and I just was, there was no hope, at least through my eyes. If it was there, I didn't see it. And I kind of half-assed the steps. That's the best way I can put it to you. I really did not. I was desperate enough to ask another woman for help, but my ego grows back so quick that it tells me that you are not like those people. You are separate. Do not do what they do. You'll be fine. And so I did 2 half-assed fifth steps. And when I mean half-assed, I mean, like, I wrote it 20 minutes before. I wrote an autobiography the first time of why it's acceptable for Adrian to hate everyone and every guy I've ever been with is an asshole and blah, 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 blah. And the 4th step, you know, when you take a searching and fearless moral inventory, I was like, what the hell is that? That sounds awful. Like, I don't want to do that. But I heard everyone else was doing it, so, you know, I got to do it. And I remember my first resentment was my dad for being a drug addict. And Paula and Julie just started laughing. They're like, really? How can you hate someone that has the same disease as you? How does that work? And I was like, hold on, I'm trying to tell a story. Like, shh. Yeah, I just was not willing to see my part in anything. And I went outside, and I'm like, okay, we'll meditate. And I was too embarrassed to say I didn't know how to meditate, so I fell asleep. And then I was like, where's my spiritual experience? AA doesn't work. Like, I'm beat. And I was convinced that AA didn't work. But I kept coming just because I didn't have anything else to do. And I liked the attention from the guys. I got to be honest with you. That's what it was. So this is where Quakertown comes into play. This is why I'm so excited to be here, because I'm so grateful for this meeting. But Julie and Paula and Dave Phillips, people that are so enthusiastic about recovery that it just, I hated it. I really hated it. Because they're talking about all these things that God has done for them. And I'm like, what God are you talking about? Because I can't feel it. You guys are either smoking crack or something because you're too happy. I don't see what there's to be happy about. You can't drink anymore. Tell me how that's fun. And but they're like, okay, we're going to Quakertown. And I'm like, that just sounds lame. I was the only one to go. But I went, and I would like to tell you that they drugged me, but I voluntarily went. But I was too afraid to tell them, no, I don't want to go. So I went. And they're like, there's this awesome speaker coming. So I immediately hated him. Immediately. And I was outside, and I remember I was just in a lot of pain. Like, I was flirting with going back out. Like, I had never wanted to drink more than I did then. And my own little personal definition of an alcoholic was, well, I'll just go to NA so that I can still drink. That doesn't sound like a bad idea. Because I was thinking about doing that. And later I found out they don't do that. But either way, I come up here. And like I said, I'm so irritated with everybody. I mean, I'm hating myself and the world. And I just think if this is what sobriety is, I am so screwed. Because I will not make it, and I know I'm going to die if I go back out. So fear sobered me for those 2 months. And a man got up here, and he was talking. He just put into words everything I felt. And I don't know why I heard it. I don't know why. I can't tell you. But his enthusiasm and his passion I really envied. And he was just talking about how amazing his life was since he went through the steps. I was like, I did that. Didn't work. Needless to say, I did not do that. I did not read the big book. I was told to read the first 164. I read the stories. I just wasn't complying. Wasn't enough pain yet. But prior to this meeting, about a week beforehand, when I would wake up in the morning, I was on rehab schedule, so I was up at like 7 ready to go. And I would have to put headphones on because I could not stop it, the spinning. Like, I would have to put music on so that I could just be. Like, I didn't understand how to do that. I was so restless. I was so irritable. I mean, I was just in pain. And I went to this girl, she's one of my good friends today, outside a meeting, and I was, like, real secretive. I was like, Steph. She's like, yeah? There's something wrong with me. Really, really wrong with me. And she's like, I think you're just an alcoholic. And I described her some of my symptoms. I was like, I hate everyone. And I feel like there's this brick of anxiety on my chest. And I was convinced that, like, I would get better. But the thing was, I'd given it about a month, and it was getting worse. And I'm like, well, and I'm in trouble. And I was like, and I think about drinking a lot. And she's like, have you been through the steps? I was like, yeah, I tried that bullshit. And she was like, no, have you really tried? And I still couldn't be honest with her. I was like, yeah, duh. And she's like, well, I think you're just an alcoholic. And I was like, bitch, you're not hearing me. I have not drank in 2 months. And I want to kill myself. And I just didn't know what to do. I was talking to that old drug dealer boyfriend of mine. And I was just flirting with the idea, just flirting with it. And it's funny how God works, because he stepped right in. And I came to this meeting, and I heard a message of hope. And 2 days later at my home group at South College, I asked Dave. I don't know why these words came out of my mouth, because they weren't supposed to, because I didn't think about it. I did not plan it out. And I hope you know that up until that point, I planned out every single conversation that I have with somebody. Like, you say that, then I'll say that, and then you'll think that of me, and it'll be great. But that did not come out. It just said, can you help me? And I swear, like, to this day, it was not me. It was God, because it didn't come from me. I didn't want his help. I didn't like him. I thought he was arrogant. But either way, God used my defects to get me through those steps, because he took me through 1 through 3. And it's funny, he said the same exact thing as Julie, as Paula, everyone else that was trying to help me, but I don't know why I heard it then. I can't tell you. It's like God just made me ready. And I went through 1 through 3, and I was balking real bad on this 4th step. Really bad. And he's like, that's not how it's done. And if you want my help, you have to do it. And I was like, oh my God, well, what's he going to think of me if I don't do this? I better do it. And I did it. And I was so thorough. I was so honest. I was like, this dude's going to think I'm a slut. And I don't, like, say, I know, like, it's not traditional to get, you know, someone of the opposite sex to help. But with God and a big book and the right motive, I don't really see a problem with it. And it's just my experience, so. But either way, Julie's still back there. She'll verify that. But I had this, we went down to Inner Harbor in Baltimore to this meeting, and just vomiting honesty of everything I've ever done and looking at my part in it. And he told me, he's like, I'm going to show you your part in everything. I was like, yeah, okay. So I had this one thing that I wanted to tell him. I was like, you can't show me my part in this. You really can't. And he said, well, what was it? And I said, well, I was sexually abused when I was like 7. I didn't have a part in that. And he said, Adrian, how old are you? And I was like, 22. I think I was 23, something like that. He's like, so how long did this happen? I was like, 15, 16, maybe 17 years ago. He's like, you're talking about it like it happened yesterday. And he said, you've been carrying that around for 17 years, using it as to you being a victim. It's affected every relationship you've ever had. And you think you're a victim. You need to forgive this person. And I was like, wow. Like, that's the power of God coming in and being able to help. Like, when I got home that night, I was told to meditate and to sit for an hour and reflect on what I'd done. And I was just getting ready to go running, because I ran at night, and I have never felt a liberation or a peace like that in my life. And I don't like comparing it to drugs or alcohol, but the high I got from drugs or alcohol doesn't rival that feeling. And the best part is it's permanent, as long as I do what's necessary to maintain and grow. And I remember when I first got drunk, I was like, this is how I'm supposed to feel. And after I did that 5th step and sit and meditating, I was like, this is how I'm supposed to feel. And this is real. This isn't synthetic. I'm actually okay with who I am. Like, all those things I thought, you know, were bad, like I said, I use them to help other women today. And on my amends, those were fun. I picked my brother first because I thought I would take the least shit from him. He sat me down for like an hour and a half straight and was like, you did this, this, and this, and this, and this. And I was like, man. But today my brothers are some of my best friends, indisputably. And that's not something I was capable of. I hope you know that. I was never able to show up and be a sister, to show up and be a daughter, anything like that. My grandmother, she was still alive at this point. It's hard for me to talk about because I miss her. But she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last December, not this past, but the one before. And my amends to her was really bothering me because I almost killed her. And she didn't remember a lot of my alcoholism. She didn't remember it, which was kind of a godsend. But I went to my mom because I didn't realize that amends were for the other person, not for me. And I didn't want to hurt anybody else because that's all I've been doing my whole life is taking from people and hurting people. And I went to my mom and I said, I need to do this. I need to make an amends somehow. And she's like, I do not want you telling her what you've done. It'll just hurt her and she doesn't remember. You're not doing that. And I ran it through my sponsor too, definitely. And they're like, no, that's not what's going to happen. You're going to be the best granddaughter that you can possibly be. You're going to go to every single doctor's appointment. You're going to help take care of her. You're going to do whatever you need to do to be there. So I did. Went to every doctor's appointment. And I took care of her when she died. And she died in May. Those about six months, there was some heavy-duty morphine, raspberry-flavored, I believe, sitting right beside me. There was OxyContin all around me. My dad's weed was downstairs. We had a bottle of Jack in the kitchen. I could have had one hell of a party if I wanted to. But that's the thing. The 10-step promises came true. It was just there, and it wasn't talking to me because I'm powerless when it's in my body, but I'm even more powerless when it's not because it talks to me. And it didn't talk. It was just there, and I was able to give her her medication like a normal human being. And if that doesn't demonstrate power, I don't know what does, because that's not me doing it. That's God, because I didn't, like Bill says in his story, I didn't have any more power in me in that moment than Ebby did. And that's the kind of miracles that continue to happen in my life today. And the most recent, what my life is like today, I always feel like I never spend enough time on this. That man that I told you about that I met that was sharing my first meeting, I'm privileged enough to be in his life today, which is really funny. He always hates that when I talk about that, but it's true, because I didn't know what a functional relationship looked like. It was a foreign concept to me for you to be respectful, and I didn't know it was not normal to make someone jealous, because if you didn't get jealous, it wasn't going to work. Like, you obviously don't care. And, to hurt someone else to have attention for yourself, you know, very selfish. I'm in school again. I spent 5 years killing brain cells. Now I'm trying to get them back. And applying principles with school, that's a whole different story. But it's fun. Sponsoring women is definitely a huge part of my life. I was helping people at 2 months sober, 2.5, actually. And I took a lot of shit for that, I hope you guys know. In AA, everyone was like, oh, my God, you're not qualified. But my sponsor was like, she had me speaking at detoxes for 34 days. And I was like, I just saw how my experience could benefit other people. And if you're not doing this, please stop selling yourself short. Because it's kind of like the grand finale when you get to see someone else grow. It doesn't always happen. Like me and my ego, I calculated how many people are actually still sober that I've taken through the steps. And it's 6%. So 6% success rate. But the point is I'm still happy and sober. But my ego wants to say, well, I have a 50% success rate. I'm better. I'm a mess. But it is a bright spot in my life. And applying principles, I can be a real bitch sometimes, let me tell you, especially at home and in the workplace when people don't do what I want. I do work around alcohol. I'm a server and a bartender. So I don't like gambling with not being spiritually fit, because I've seen so many people within the past year not only die from this but go back out. And it's like, if I stop doing the work to get the power, I don't have any power, and then my mind goes insane again, and then I drink, and it gets ugly, and I don't want to do that. In a nutshell, that's what happens. And I just like the results today. Is basically the peace of mind that I have I've never had. I never thought that was possible. I thought my life was going to be like, okay, we're going to go to AA for a couple months, try to get your shit together, go back out, we'll be in rehab for Christmas, it'll be fine. Like, I thought that's what my life was going to be. A couple suicide attempts, you know, never any happiness, never any joy or peace. But for the most part, if I suffer today, it's at my own hand. It's what am I not doing? Recently, my aunt just died in early December. Something similar to like Lou Gehrig's disease. And I was there when she died. And it's a really spiritual thing to be able to be of service to your family. Because whenever someone died, I was like, oh my God, poor me, poor me. Look at me, look at me. And it's just not how it is. To be able to be there. But, and I got turned away from the nursing program I tried to get back into. And, first thing I thought of is how delusional I am. How am I going to feed my children? Is the first thing I thought of. And I'm like, I don't have children. but honestly, like, that's how I look at it. I have to have a job, I have to have this, this, and this. It's like, whoa, why don't we just live in the moment? And Christmas was coming. I was strung out over grades and stuff, and I was just having a hard time. And I wasn't doing the things I was supposed to do. It was like a 10-step. I was doing my 11-step review at night, but do you have an apology? Yeah, probably. Should you talk to someone about this? Yeah. Not going to, though. And it's like, okay, well, then you sit and suffer, basically, is how it is. And still sponsoring people. But the thing was, I got into a lot of pain. And I'm at her funeral. And I'm in this church, and for whatever reason, I just had this really weird feeling. I was like, I don't belong here. I feel inferior. God doesn't want anything to do with me. That old mentality of how God was came back. So I prayed. I said, God, I feel a little lost. Could you help me? I'm just kind of praying for faith. And I kid you not, my cousin, who barely knew my aunt, barely knew her, lives in York, came down, and he was sitting on the other side, and I thought I was, you know, playing it cool, smiling, trying to help people, you know. He came up to me after this, and he was celebrating 25 years of sobriety on that day. And he's one of these people in sobriety that still is really active with 25 years. I saw people with 25 years. I'm like, God, why would you do that? That sounds awful when I first came in. But he's actually still does the deal and helps people and applies principles. He came up to me. I kid you not. The first words out of his mouth were, do you feel inferior in church? And I was like, yeah. How'd you know? And we had an hour and a half conversation about spiritual principles, about a couple of meditation things. I talked about that 10-step that I was supposed to do, and I got right back on track. Now, if I hadn't went to God, I wouldn't have wanted to talk to Roger. I'd have been like, yeah, I'm fine, get out of here. And I went about my day. But since I turned to God, he used someone else to help me. And that's basically how my life works. That's how God works in my life. And as long as I stay out of the way, it ends up pretty smoothly. All the outside things, I got to tell you, I made a lot more money in my addiction than I do now. But I'm happy now, genuinely. Outside things do not dictate my happiness anymore. My relationship with God does. And as long as I continue to try to take care of his other kids, that third step promise comes true. I have everything I need. And most of the time, everything I want, too, in all honesty. And the biggest thing I've ever wanted is just to be comfortable with me and just to be comfortable with, you know, the world in general. And I am. And it's a beautiful thing for me to get up here and tell you that I don't think of a drink or a drug, because that was the strongest driving force in my life, and it's not anymore. And the only thing I can attribute that to is getting a sponsor, getting into the big book, coming to meetings, and most importantly, getting through these steps and helping other people, because that saved my life, and it gave me a life. And I'm just privileged enough to come back and speak at the meeting that was such a huge proponent in me getting sober and happy. So thank you guys for having me.